Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement by the Vatican today that it would open its secret World War II archives on the papacy of Pope Pius XII, who has been accused of keeping silent about the genocide of the Jews by the Nazis, aided by the Italian fascist, at the time of the Holocaust, even when Jews were deported from Rome to Auschwitz. Ruth Ben-Ghiat, a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University who studies fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, and propaganda, joins us to discuss the move by Pope Francis to open up the archives which the American Jewish Committee has been calling for access to for 30 years. And while Pope Francis said that Pius's legacy had been treated with, quote, some prejudice and exaggeration, the fact that the wartime Pope did not speak against the persecution of the Jews and later the murder of 6 million of them has long been a matter of controversy among scholars, particularly those from the leading Holocaust Memorial Institutes in Israel and the U.S., who are now welcoming the opening of the secret archives by the Pope, which is scheduled for March the 2nd, 2020. Then we'll get a summary of the events surrounding the CPAC conference, which ended on Saturday with President Trump's bizarre, rambling 2.5-hour address after 2 days of Hillary haters and Hitler lovers hectoring members of the liberal press as speakers warned of the feminization of American manhood by soy eaters, along with the impending Muslim invasion and the socialist takeover of America. Will Sommer, a tech reporter for The Daily Beast, who covered CPAC 2019, joins us to discuss his article, Anti-Muslim Activist Laura Loomer Banned from CPAC After Harassing Reporters, and how today's GOP is now the party of MAGA-hatted white nationalist Trump followers. Then finally, we will speak with Michael Crapon, the co-director of the Henry L. Stimson Center and director of its South Asia and Space Security Program, about his article at the New York Times, The Age of Nuclear Confrontation Will Not End Well. He joins us to discuss the need for Congress to fill the void since the White House is taking the nation and the world on a reckless path away from deterrence and diplomacy towards nuclear brinkmanship and confrontation. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of image. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ruth Ben-Ghiat.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us, Ruth. And what do you make of Pope Francis deciding to open up the secret World War II archives on the papacy of Pope Pius XII, who has been accused of keeping silent about the genocide of the Jews by the Nazis?
It's a very interesting move, and we always can ask why they're doing it at this time, because the Vatican is a very old and pragmatic institution, and they usually have a reason for doing things at a certain time. People have been wanting them to open these archives for decades. And, you know, it could be that they want to finally have some kind of openness about the reputation of Pius XII during the World War II, which is the crux of the problem, or it could be a gesture that's meant to take attention off the other scandals and bad press that the church is getting.
Well, the American Jewish Committee have been trying to get access to these archives for 30 years. So is it that kind of pressure, or is it what some suggest is that on the path to sainthood, which previous popes have been given, Pius XII has somewhat been stalled on that trajectory because of this controversy that's sort of lingering about his role in World War II?
It could be part of that. I think that, but, you know, even if these archives are going to open in March 2020, it's going to take many, many years before books come out. I'm sure people already, the regulars at the Vatican Secret Archives already have their appointments made for March 1st or whatever the exact day is.
March 2nd, yeah.
March 2nd. But it takes years for scholarly work to, you know, be published. And so I think that it's going to take a long time before there's enough research to, if his sanctification process hinges on that, it's not going to be a rapid decision. I also think that they've been preparing for this for some time, and there are something like 17 million documents, and the Vatican is a very methodical place that is dedicated to excellence in archival practices. And I have actually worked at the Vatican Secret Archive. I'm one of the few who has gotten in to see another collection that was opened and then closed again for World War II. So I have direct experience with how careful and methodical they are.
So if there were incriminating documents, they would not be destroyed or hidden?
It's hard to say. Archival practices, you never quite know. I've worked in many, many international archives, and you never quite know if you're getting the full document record. Because if they don't want someone to see something, they don't put it in the inventory. And the Vatican, before they open up a collection, they often do a very detailed inventory of the documents, which this is partly why it takes such a long time. But again, they just simply don't put that in the inventory, and then you never knew it existed. And you maybe only hear about it later. In the state archives in Italy years ago, there were episodes where the head of the archive was discovered to have taken home for safekeeping incriminating documents about certain important people. And so no one working at the archive ever knew that they were there.
So how much is the perceptions that are out there in the public from the Da Vinci Code movies, et cetera, how does that gel with what you experienced, having been one of the few people that were allowed into the Vatican archives to see these previously secret World War II documents?
Well, my experience is probably instructive for understanding parts of this, because what I was able to see was a particular collection called the Pontifical Assistance Commission, and they were do-gooders, and they had an enormous operation that helped people get home from concentration camps. They helped displaced persons get home. It was quite an amazing scope of an operation. And the reason the Vatican opened this collection in the early 2000s, and I used it twice in the space of 8 years, is that the Red Cross, the International Red Cross in Geneva, had opened its archives of all the work that they did to help people get home from World War II. And the Vatican wanted to make sure that they, you know, were also recognized. And I don't blame them, having seen, you know, just a little bit of what they did. Priests went into concentration camps and arranged for transport. It was really an enormous operation. And so that's why they opened that collection of World War II. But nothing else was open for a very long time. So if we can extrapolate from that, there's a reason they're going to open it now. Do they think that Pius XII will come out in a better light than rumor has it, or just circumstantial evidence? Probably, because otherwise maybe they wouldn't open it.
Well, the Pope himself has said that Pope Pius's legacy has been treated with some prejudice and exaggeration. So he seems to be pretty confident that Pius will be essentially, well, he actually, just to quote him again, the Church is not afraid of history. So when you talked about a minute ago about after World War II, when the death camps were uncovered to the horror of the world, and that the Catholic Church stepped up along with the Red Cross, that was also the time where many accusations had been leveled against Pope Pius, and not so much him personally, but the church that he presided over, in creating the so-called rat line, where prominent Nazis and murderers were allowed to escape to South America. Did that come up in your research?
It didn't come up. I was looking at something pretty specific, which was the Vatican helping Italian prisoners of war and other European prisoners of war to get home. So I was looking at their enormous collections. So I was kind of focused on that. But in the process, I found, these documents and testimonies by priests, like a parish priest from a small town in Italy would go into Germany, and he would see these horrors. And then there were a lot of military chaplains who were assigned, of course, during World War II. And these people were also in the camps. Some of them went, voluntarily into the camps so they could kind of give religious assistance to the prisoners of war. So from that work certainly balances the rat line story, because there you have open collaboration with Nazism, right? And here you have helping victims of Nazism. And the testimonies of some of the priests are very, very strong documents. So you have a different story. So I suspect that in time, with the different kinds of books and articles that will come out of this new opening, we will have a more of a context for the things that we hear or know about Pius XII, that he didn't openly denounce, the genocide going on, that he was very cautious to a fault. And I have a feeling that we'll come to know the circumstances he was operating in better from this archive.
Well, it's more than the World War II experience of the genocide itself. The persecution of Jews prior to the genocide, my understanding is that Pius XII was silent on that. And then, of course, on the actual genocide of 6 million Jews. In 1942, there was an Allied declaration in December of 1942 condemning the Nazi extermination of Jews. And he did not sign that declaration, the Pope, or the Catholic Church didn't sign onto it, nor did he make any statements about the deportation of Jews from Rome to Auschwitz. Are those fair criticisms?
Yeah, and the latter one, if you've been to Rome, the Roman ghetto is just down the river of the Tiber River from the Vatican. And it was seen as a huge betrayal that these were kind of the Pope's Jews, the Roman Jews. Because the Pope is this international, universal figure, and then he's also a Roman. and so this was seen, this was seen as a huge black mark. But the whole history of the Catholic Church with fascism, with Italian fascism, that archive has been open now for like 10 years. They don't have a very good record for that either. For example, when Mussolini was coming to power, there was a Catholic party that was a kind of very progressive Catholic party. And they were new in 1920, and they were getting like 20-25% of the vote, and they would have been a viable party. And the Vatican connived with Mussolini to shut them down. And then all that was left was the left and fascism, and then the liberals who were in power. And they really just decided to shut this down completely, and then backed Mussolini the whole time. So then you have, things evolve, and you have the Axis and the Nazis into the Holocaust. But they have this long history of being very self-protective and doing what is necessary to keep the church going. That's their pragmatic. That's why I used that word before.
Well, the Polish Pope, he was very, very conservative, as was his successor, the German Pope, Benedict, who's still alive and still, actually, I think actually still is a pope. I'm not sure exactly or the division of labor there is between him and Francis. But he, being Polish, you would have thought that he would have been really understood exactly what happened. And he never really spoke out. He spoke out against communism and was a very effective force. And he spoke out against liberal priests, again, somewhat along the lines of what you're talking about in the 1920s in Italy, particularly those that were associated with the liberation theology. So how do you see that particular pope in the light of what's coming out now? Again, the AJC has been asking for these access to this archives for 30 years.
Yeah, well, it's very telling that that pope denounced communism but didn't want to denounce fascism. And I think that whatever's in these archives, and again, there's 17 million documents. You know, I don't know who the first people who will be allowed to work with them, because archives, there's going to be a big rush of people, and archives know certain people and they let certain people in and others have to wait. So we don't know what will come out. But it's very telling that no popes have made a big statement on this subject. And perhaps they're saying, well, we don't have the information. But the Jesuit, there were attempts to use these documents without making them public. They had a commission of Jesuit historians who went through and published some documents from it years and years ago. But, you know, people weren't sure if this was a very, very edited version. And so historians like to be able to get their own hands on documents, because I can tell you that you can have a book of edited documents or even something much less controversial. And sometimes the edit of the document takes out the kind of hot potato stuff. And again, the Catholic Church is a very self-protective institution. So I think that people want to see with their own eyes the full documents, and then we'll see what comes out of it.
Well, self-protective is putting it mildly when it comes to sex abuse.
Yeah, well, I'm speaking about toward their history.
Right,
yeah.
But you were saying earlier that they might want to distract from this endless, endless scandal about sex abuse, which they don't seem to be able to get their hands around. So would this be relatively easy compared? I mean, the Pope just had a conclave to deal with sex abuse, and there was an expectation that maybe that would be finite, that something would come out of it that would finally put a stop to the endless agony and some clarity. And it didn't happen, to the disappointment of many.
No. The scope of that problem, I mean, it's just come out fairly recently that the issue of nuns being abused by priests. Mm-hmm. So we have children being abused, we have nuns. And the issue has to do with, you know, the structural things about the church, and it's the scope of it is enormous. And, of course, we don't know the full scope of it yet. I think it's going to, I'm not sure they want to deal with the magnitude of it because of what it might mean for the church and some of its policies that have been the center of its doctrine for years. You know, in many centuries ago, there were popes who had children fairly openly. But that was a way of doing things, and then it evolved to a different way. So I don't think this is a distraction, because these books are not going to come out anytime soon from this new archive that's opening. But I think that it is a gesture of goodwill to open up this archive, and they need all the gestures they can get right now.
Well, Ruth Benguet, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ruth Benguet, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images. We're going to take a brief station break and back with a summary of the events surrounding the CPAC conference, which ended on Saturday with President Trump's bizarre, rambling 2.5-hour address. Thank you.
clowns. Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours. Making my entrance again with my usual flair.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Will Sommer, a tech reporter for The Daily Beast, who previously worked as a campaign editor at The Hill and as a political columnist for Washington City Paper. His latest article at The Daily Beast is anti-Muslim activist Laura Loomer banned from CPAC after harassing reporters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Sommer.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks, Will. And you've also wrote at least two other articles about the recent CPAC conference that ended over the weekend, one of which is No Place for Soy Boys, a tribute to men outside CPAC, and the other is CPAC 2019, Turning Point USA's Charlie Kirk and Candace Owens are the new king and queen of the GOP ball. Let's start with the Soy Boys, just to explain what that is. There was a sidebar conference or gathering, I take it, when was it, Thursday or Friday of last week, called A Tribute to Men, and the attendees are afraid that men are being turned into soy boys, which is conservative slang for a feminized liberal man, based on the idea that they eat soy products instead of red meat. So let's start with that one. I mean, what is this thing in conservative circles about the beleaguered white man? I mean, so much, if you cut through it all, that seems to be a really consistent theme, that somehow white men are beleaguered and beaten up in our culture.
Right. I mean, that's absolutely the case. You know, it's something you see really kind of across the right, whether that's, you know, people who legitimately believe that eating soy products is going to, you know, physically change their essence or something like that, you know, to things we saw like with the Covington Catholic students, where that incident was portrayed as kind of like an example of how of the idea that white men are kind of under attack more generally. So this event was, you know, it was a pretty quiet CPAC in terms of like the real crazies. But this event was, you know, one of the more outlandish ones. This idea that, you know, men and especially straight white men need kind of an event to celebrate them because they're otherwise so attacked in the culture.
And the Proud Boys were in attendance, right? I noticed that it wasn't the founder also present at the main CPAC conference?
So the founder, Gavin McGinnis, I don't believe was there, but the current leader of the Proud Boys was there, as well as some other, you know, leaders in the group. Yeah, this is a far right kind of men's fraternity that's been involved in some violent incidents, you know, has had some racist members, stuff like that. And so they really took a lead role at this tribute for men. And then they were kind of carousing surrounding the conference. At one point, a Proud Boy was offered a reporter's business card and he ate it. So that kind of gives you a sense of the people we're dealing with.
So, and also earlier in the CPAC season, starting on Thursday night, you covered this group, what was it, a ball at which Turning Point USA's Charlie Kirk and Candace Owens, I don't know whether they were crowned the new king and queen, but describe
yeah,
that.
They had one of kind of the signature events of CPAC on Thursday night. They threw a big party. So Turning Point USA is this kind of campus conservative organization that in practice is really aimed at as much at wealthy, middle-aged or elderly donors. Their promise is essentially, you know, we're the front line against millennials all being liberals. And so they take in a ton of money and then they kind of distribute this money to college students and as well as kind of boosting their own profiles. And so, you know, you have figures like Charlie Kirk, Candace Owens, Kyle Kashev, who is the sort of anti-gun control student from Parkland High School. And they were really like, you know, some of the biggest celebrities at CPAC. And so every year CPAC kind of has some, you know, there's kind of some themes and, you know, some new stars. And I would say this year, really, Charlie Kirk and Candace Owens were really the big figures. I mean, they had a big cutout, Charlie Kirk, that, you know, his fans could pose with, stuff like that.
And Candace Owens is an African-American woman, right, who probably wouldn't be quite so prominent, but for the fact that she's an African-American.
Well, you know, a lot of her appeal is built on the idea of that, you know, she's going to convince black voters to leave the Democratic Party. She has an organization called Blexit. So, you know, it's kind of a pun on Brexit. It's like black voters leaving or exiting the Democratic Party. You know, she's kind of had some high profile flops. She made these like weirdly positive comments about Hitler in December. She was briefly embraced by Kanye West, and then she seems to have you know, kind of overplayed her hand in that relationship. As one conservative activist I know said, they overgrifted it, and so Kanye sort of distanced himself from her. So she's a very controversial figure, even on the right.
So the group itself, though, is it Turning Point USA? Is that associated with David Horowitz?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, beyond just general kind of like right-wing stuff.
Uh-huh. Because he's been funded to an enormous degree by right-wing billionaires, etc. So I just assume that somehow, since he's been able to tap into that kind of money, largely because he's kind of a prodigal son, he used to be a lefty.
Oh, sure.
They love that stuff, you know.
I mean, certainly they're politically very simpatico.
Yeah, I see. So then I'm just going through your observations and your articles, Will Sommer. And again, I'm speaking with Will Sommer, who's a tech reporter for The Daily Beast, who previously worked as a campaign editor at The Hill and was a political columnist for Washington City Paper. And his latest article, The Daily Beast, is anti-Muslim activist Laura Loomer banned from CPAC after harassing reporters. So let's turn to that. I love the idea that Laura Loomer, who's is she a protege of Alex Jones, or are they just simpatico?
I believe she's been on InfoWars. You know, really, Laura Loomer, I would say her sort of direct, like, ideological or tactical mentor would be James O'Keefe.
I see. The Veritas dirty trickster.
Right, exactly. And so she worked for him at one point and now has kind of struck out on her own. And her signature tactic is, you know, just as James O'Keefe is very into undercover stings, her signature tactic is sort of just yelling at people in public and, you know, yelling at James Comey or Hillary Clinton. And naturally, I mean, she's very, I guess, hard to reason with. You know, she doesn't, you know, she'll get a response from someone and then she'll kind of just start yelling at them more. And so inevitably the people she calls this loomering, obviously a play on her name. And, you know, you generally, if you get loomered, you don't come off looking good because people get kind of flustered and then they escape from her and stuff like that. And so so she decided to bring this tactic to CPAC and was chasing down various journalists she has disagreements with, including, I should say, myself.
So you were loomered.
I was. Yeah. She and some of her associates caught me while I was waiting in line for coffee. They essentially, you know, I made the mistake, I think, of talking to them. And so, you know, they keep kind of pestering you with these questions that are along the lines of, you know, kind of, when did you stop beating your wife? You know, these kind of very incriminating questions. And so, you know, eventually I said, okay, you know, that's enough. And then they sort of pursue you through the conference, you know, yelling things. And so the bigger thing was she went after a CNN reporter and used her media pass to go into the media room and, you know, really harass people there. So on the final day, she had her pass pulled and was essentially banned from CPAC.
Well, she's already been kicked off Twitter, PayPal, Uber, Lyft, and even the food delivery service, Uber Eats.
Yes. Yeah, she's been kicked off a lot of things. You know, Twitter seems to be the one that really galls her because, you know, with a lot of these right-wing provocateurs, once they're kicked off a social media service, that's a huge blow to their – they basically don't exist if they're not on Twitter or Instagram, stuff like that, as we've seen with people like Milo Yiannopoulos. So, you know, once Laura got kicked off Twitter, she got very aggravated. She famously chained herself to the front door of Twitter's New York office. And so, you know, she was walking around CPAC with this shirt with her own face on it, you know, saying like, you know, let Laura back on Twitter. So that seems to be a lot of the agita right now.
Well, the description, though, of her being kicked out of CPAC with the security guards not letting her in and taking away her pass, where she pleaded with him saying, Don Jr. follows me on Instagram and Kimberly Guilfoyle, the fiancé, follows me on Instagram.
Yes. It's funny stuff. I mean, the thing that this speaks to more broadly is this kind of this tension at CPAC, which the American Conservative Union, which puts on CPAC and its head, Matt Schlapp, whose wife works in the White House, they sort of see themselves as the arbiters of, you know, what lines are not going to be crossed in conservatism system and sort of what, you know, they you know, who is beyond the pale. So, for example, last year, a lot of white nationalists showed up and were not on the bill to speak at CPAC, but were kind of roaming the halls. So this year they were banned, and then they kind of set up camp in the lobby and were complaining. Then, of course, you see Laura Loomer gets kicked out. So there's this kind of this constant tension between people further on the right than the American Conservative Union, who were trying to sort of use CPAC to promote their own ideas, and, you know, inevitably getting banned.
Well, in general, though, the impression one has, we all already know that the GOP has become the party of Trump, and very, very few, and of course those few sort of traditional Republicans, the kind of Chamber of Commerce types who criticize Trump, particularly the senators Corker and Flake, have gone. So the impression you have is that everybody in the GOP, particularly in the Senate, are cowering, and in the House too, for that matter, that, you know, you can't afford to cross Trump because he's so popular with the base. But is it now, have the MAGA people literally taken over the GOP and all of these kind of Weekly Standard types and the traditional Chamber of Commerce types? Are they simply an extinct species of Republican?
More or less, yes. I mean, you know, in terms of any actual power, they really don't, you know, your never Trump types really don't wield any power. And I would say, you know, when they appear on Fox News, or excuse me, when they appear on something like CNN, I mean, these people basically only exist now either in the CNN green room or the New York Times op-ed pages. There was no question that CPAC was really, you know, it was all in for Trump this year. All the attendees were. Last year, a never Trump columnist, Mona Charon, went off on Trump during a panel. And that became so controversial with so many booing and stuff like that, that unless I'm wrong, I don't think any really like committed never Trump people were on any of the panels this year. So you really saw have seen sort of the extinction of that group within the GOP. And that was really typified at CPAC. And of course, then when Trump came out for his own speech, I mean, standing room only, the crowd loved it.
So how evident was the white supremacist? You said that last year they were kicked out. This year they kind of roamed the halls or outside. We mentioned earlier the Proud Boys, not their leader, Gavin McGinnis, but their founder, but their new leaders were in attendance. And this white nationalist, Peter Brimelow, he seemed to have also got a lot of people's attention, not to mention Michelle Malkin, who made a speech, did she not?
Right, exactly. So Michelle Malkin gave a speech, and she, you know, she later gave an interview to VDare, which is a white nationalist publication that I believe Peter Brimelow runs. So, you know, again, you know, I guess earlier perhaps I suggested that the boundary between your white nationalists and your more, I guess, not racist or not explicitly racist conservatives is clear at CPAC, and in many ways it sort of isn't, because you have like someone like Peter Brimelow, as I said, was able to get into CPAC, and you have people, you know, sort of, it's all gradations of, you know, further down the right, and there isn't really a hard line being put down.
Well, Michelle Malkin gave an interview to this VDare publication. The interview was this woman called Faith Goldie, and she's a white nationalist. She's appeared on the podcast for the Daily Stormer, which is the neo-Nazi white supremacist website, right? And they even advocate the gassing of Jews.
Right, that's exactly right. I mean, the Daily Stormer is as sort of explicitly neo-Nazi as you can get, essentially. And so, you know, Faith Goldie lost a previous job after she went on that podcast. She was down in Charlottesville kind of chumming it up with white nationalists or neo-Nazi marchers. She's recommended that people read, that her followers read a book by a sort of quasi-Nazi character from World War II. She, you know, more recently she ran for mayor of Toronto. And she, you know, she was endorsed by Steve King, a congressman here, and that sort of set off all this trouble for him. So really, I mean, it's not like these characters are entirely banned or shunned at CPAC.
Well, the other person who gave a speech, of course, was Sebastian Gorka, former White House deputy assistant to President Trump. He, of course, has pretty well-established right-wing credentials from Hungary. He was sporting a medal from a pro-Nazi Hungarian group. I believe that his father belonged to, if I'm not mistaken.
That's absolutely right. I mean, this was all like in the spotlight when Gorka was working in the White House. This is a guy who has ties to really far right Hungarian groups that venerate Nazis or their fascist collaborators within that country in World War II. So, you know, there's a lot of characters at CPAC with very unsavory reputations who nevertheless have really been sort of welcomed in to the fold there. You know, Michelle Malkin wrote a book defending the internment of Japanese citizens or Japanese American citizens during World War II. You know, Sebastian Gorka, we discussed his stuff, and both of these people had speaking slots.
But the keynote speaker, and this is the amazing part, Will Simon, the keynote speaker, of course, was President Trump. He comes on stage, literally wraps himself in the flag, and then goes on a 2-hour and 20-minute rant. And you can catch the highlights of it on various websites. It is truly amazing. And I have often argued that I don't believe Trump will leave the Oval Office in an orange jumpsuit or in a straitjacket, but that he will have a public meltdown like Howard Beale in the movie Network, which is now a Broadway play. He came awfully close to being Howard Beale, in my opinion. What did you think?
You know, it certainly is one of the stranger speeches the president has given, which, you know, obviously is really saying something. So, you know, I mean, he comes out, he embraces, he like just hugs this flag. He tells some bizarre stories. You know, I mean, he's known for sort of telling these strange stories that don't go anywhere. But even by those standards, I mean, this was a very odd one. It went for more than 2 hours. You know, there's a lot of, reportedly, it's the longest speech he's ever given while president. So it was really bizarre. But, you know, it's a sign that, you know, of how devoted CPAC and these conservative activists are to the president, that they really ate it up. I mean, so much of his presidency and especially his speeches is based on really sort of, you know, what they call owning the libs, like really, you know, essentially thumbing his nose at his foes and sometimes his allies, because, you know, he went off this whole rant on Jeff Sessions, his former attorney general, calling him ineffective and weak. So
in a mock Southern accent.
Exactly. In a Southern accent. So it really, like, more and more, I think we're seeing the president use his speeches to sort of, you know, he does his greatest hits, and, you know, he brags about the election win nearly 3 years ago. And then he also, you know, he goes off on sort of whoever he's mad at the time.
So just in closing, if the CPAC people are the new Republican Party, what is their platform for 2020? My impression is that maybe they're going to segue away from Hillary Clinton as the all-purpose boogeyman, lock her up, lock her up, to what seems to be the GOP's new platform, and that is to run against socialists and to conflate the socialism of Maduro's catastrophe in Venezuela with what will happen if AOC and Bernie Sanders take over.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You're seeing a lot more talk about socialism, both at CPAC and in other places like Fox News. I mean, this idea that now that there's two members of the Democratic Socialists of America in Congress, I mean, they're treating like this like just like the socialist takeover of America. You know, we saw, of course, during the State of the Union when the president said America would never be a socialist country. That really is the thing. You know, I would say, though, that even though Hillary Clinton is receding from public life and her role in the Democratic Party, that, you know, they're still chanting lock her up. You know, they were chanting it during the Trump speech. So, you know, I don't think they're done going after her either just yet.
Well, Will Sumner, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again. And I've been speaking with Will Sumner, who's a tech reporter for The Daily Beast, who previously worked as a campaign editor at The Hill and as a political columnist for Washington City Paper. And his latest article at The Daily Beast is anti-Muslim activist Laura Loomer banned from CPAC after harassing reporters. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing the need for the Congress to fill the void since the White House is taking the nation and the world on a reckless path away from deterrence and diplomacy towards nuclear brinkmanship and confrontation.
Bruce Rodner!
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck!
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul!
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J!
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu!
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin!
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich!
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole less truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Crapon, co-founder of the Henry L. Stimson Center and director of its South Asia and Space Security Programs. Previously, he worked in the Carter administration on Capitol Hill and at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of 20 books, including Better Safe Than Sorry, The Ironies of Living with the Bomb, and Deterrent Stability and Escalation Control in South Asia. And he has an article at the New York Times, The New Age of Nuclear Confrontation Will Not End Well. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Crapon.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you so much.
And your piece in the New York Times, of course, the failing New York Times, I'm not sure that Donald Trump reads it, although it is his hometown paper, and he wishes that they would treat him better. But what he's doing doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, he boasts about spending $716 billion on defense and is building up nuclear arsenals and building I think they've already started to build a low-yield nuclear weapon that they're going to put on top of a Trident missile, which seems to be the worst possible idea in the world. So he seems to equate strength with money. But does he understand the legacy and value of these arms control treaties and the combination of deterrence and diplomacy that have meant that a nuclear weapon has not been fired in anger since Nagasaki?
I think he understands deterrence. I don't think he has much skill at diplomacy. And he hasn't really figured out the mix. And since diplomacy isn't happening, he's always got deterrence.
Well, what about this? He keeps referring to his uncle that was at MIT, and that's how he gets his advice. Do you know anything about that or who this uncle was and what kind of qualifications he has to be Donald Trump's nuclear expert?
Whoever he may be, or whoever he was, he's better than John Bolton.
So, John Bolton, of course, is busy tearing up treaties, and he will probably continue to do so, but he does actually work for Donald Trump. At this point, the ABM treaty was torn up under George W. Bush, and then the INF treaty has just been torn up. There's not much left, right, except the New START treaty, which limits longer-range missiles.
That's the last big one that's in place. There are other important treaties that haven't entered into force but are being respected. I'm referring there to the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. But New START is the last one we got in terms of putting limits, constraints on the longest range nuclear forces. And if that goes by the boards, and it might well, then we're back to 1972. In 1972, there were no constraints. There were no limitations on U.S. and Soviet nuclear forces. And Nixon and Brezhnev agreed to some, and Washington and Moscow have been agreeing to some ever since. And these arms limitation and reduction agreements were backstopped by the treaty that you mentioned earlier, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. So as long as both superpowers conceded vulnerability to each other, they were able to limit And then when conditions permitted, they were able to deeply reduce their nuclear arsenals. So now the ABM Treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, is no more, as you said. George W. Bush, hearkening to the advice of John Bolton, got rid of it. And then Putin responded by getting rid of something he didn't like. And now we really don't have much of a nuclear safety net.
But don't they understand? I mean, I don't know about Bolton, but Trump, and obviously he's very difficult. He doesn't listen to his intelligence people. He doesn't believe in experts. But the idea that you withdraw from a treaty, and if the other side has been violating this treaty, as long as you're in the treaty regime, you can at least negotiate it with the other side and get inspections and get them to remedy their violations. But once you're out of the treaty, then all bets are off. And that's what's happened with Putin. They said that he was violating it with a new cruise missile. Now that the U.S. has pulled out of the INF treaty, Putin can build as many of these new cruise missiles as he wants.
You're right. And let's go back to this anti-ballistic missile treaty, because the Soviets violated that one, too. You may recall, they built a radar installation where it didn't belong. And it was a violation, and there was no bones about it. But the U.S. side didn't pick up its bags and leave the negotiating table. And we kept hammering away, and we kept talking, and we kept embarrassing the Kremlin. And lo and behold, a guy named Mikhail Gorbachev tore it down. So the treaty still served a very valuable purpose, even though it was violated and subsequently corrected. But that's not how Bolton and Trump play. It's my way or the highway. If you don't do what I dictate, then I'm out of here. And that was basically the way they approached this violation, and it was a violation by the Russian side of this treaty, the INF treaty, that was signed by Gorbachev and Reagan, and it broke the back of the nuclear arms race. It was an amazing treaty. But now, bits are off, and I think we can expect new Euro missiles once again.
Well, he's got some Buck Rogers things, Putin, that he promises that he's got up his sleeve, you know, these ultrasonic and the torpedo that goes faster than a speeding bullet and all of this stuff. So, you know, I don't know where you separate rhetoric from reality, but still, none of this is good. Have either of them noticed, this two superpowers, what just happened between Pakistan and India? It's my understanding that the real crisis was not so much in Islamabad or New Delhi, it was in Washington, D.C., because there was nobody minding the store. Trump was over in North Korea and watching the television testimony of Michael Cohen. You know, normally when you have these kind of crises, even if they don't involve nuclear weapons, the U.S. does try to calm things down. No such thing happened as far as we know. I think Pompeo...
The U.S. has played, and the United States was absolutely crucial in helping India and Pakistan climb down from previous crises.
Right.
But Washington wasn't available. There were phone calls, and other capitals made phone calls. But you know what? I'm kind of thinking, this may sound heretical to you, but not being available, not being reliable, really forced New Delhi and Islamabad to work it out. And I think they showed good judgment after they made their points. And they were very careful not to do some escalatory things that have occurred in previous crises. Like in 2001, some wild men from the same group that was behind the latest episode of shooting up and through and using a car bomb to kill 40 policemen, Indian policemen in Kashmir. The same group sent some vigilantes to shoot up the Indian Parliament building in 2001. And both sides mobilized for war. There were about 1 million troops ready to fight after that incident back in 2001. Well, this time, you didn't read in your newspaper anything about mobilizations. Yes, there was increased readiness, but both sides were careful in their signaling. And you didn't read in your newspapers about missiles being moved and being ready to fire, as has been the case in previous crises. My point is that grown-ups were in charge of this flare-up, and they were careful to keep this thing under control. And I believe, I could be wrong, but the non-availability of the U.S. president might have helped them sort it out without resort to escalation.
Well, it is a paradoxical observation, Michael. And, you know, to some extent, neither Russia nor the United States has a lot of credibility in telling other countries that they should reduce their nuclear arsenals, because we have massive arsenals compared to every other country. China still kept its strategic nuclear arsenal down to about 300 warheads. So neither Russia nor the United States makes much sense in that regard. And you've mentioned earlier that the virtue of treaties, of course, is that when there is a violation, it can be dealt with, as was the case with the ABM treaty over the Krasnoyarsk radar. So the other point, though, that you make in your article at the New York Times, A New Age of Nuclear Confrontation Will Not End Well, Michael Crapon, is that because you've got, this is how it ends, the more Mr. Trump flails, Mr. Bolton tears down, and Mr. Putin sows fear and broadcasts threats, the more Capitol Hill is obliged to step up. The nuclear safety net that previous generations bequeathed to us is in desperate need of repair. For the time being, there's nowhere else to turn but Congress. So given that, what do you know about Congress? Are they paying attention? Is there anybody? Of course, we do have a divided Congress with the Democrats controlling the House and the Republicans the Senate. Do you see people on Capitol Hill that are trying to run with the ball here and do what's necessary because of the lack of focus and purpose in the Oval Office and in the White House?
Well, there's one guy who's paying attention who happens to be sitting in a very responsible committee assignment. His name is Adam Smith. What a great name for a congressman. Adam Smith represents part of Seattle. He's the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. Now, he has a formidable opposite member on the Senate Armed Services Committee, a senator by the name of James Imhoff, and those two will be sparring over compromises in the defense authorization bill. And Smith has some good ideas. Parts of this very large modernization package that will cost the American taxpayer upwards of $2 trillion, that's for the T, $2 trillion over the next three decades when these forces will be constructed and maintained in the field. Some of this is just makes no sense on any grounds. And some of it you may disagree with, but I think reasonable people can come to the conclusion that using a mini nuke on top of a Trident missile to deal with the possibility of escalation control, say, in the Baltic states. Now, that's a crazy idea. That one makes no sense. I don't think the Navy, if they would give their true opinion of the matter, would think it's a great idea. I don't think the Navy would think putting new nuclear warheads on surface ships, something that George H.W. Bush decided was a bad idea when the Cold War ended, to go back in that direction. I don't think the Navy is enthusiastic about that. These weapons get in the way. They get in the way. They're weapons that we dare not use. So, yeah, deterrence. We can't throw that away. Not until the world changes dramatically. Diplomacy is the thing that's missing. We could also use some common sense. And Democrats in the House, where the majority lies now, amongst their ranks, have got a lot of work to do.
Well, just in closing, we know that during the Yeltsin period, the Norwegians sent up a research rocket satellite, and the Russians, the Kasbah Crocus system, picked it up. And according to their computer tapes, they thought it was a Trident missile because the signature was the same as a Trident launch. And then they brought in the Cheget, the football, to Yeltsin and said, now you've got to retaliate. You know, Americans have launched a Trident missile. And that's a strategic weapon with multiple warheads. And mercifully, the trajectory started to change and they realized it wasn't heading their way. And the crisis was over. But within seconds, Yeltsin was faced with whether to launch. So we know that the Russian system has signatures of what American missiles look like. So if you fire a Trident with a tiny little warhead meant to hit a terrorist camp, you're going to start World War III. I mean, how stupid can these people be?
It doesn't make sense. And I actually think the Congress is going to put an end to it. The Department of Energy has started producing these warheads, but this program is not a done deal.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it, Michael Crapon.
Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Michael Crapon, who is the co-founder of the Henry L. Stimson Center and director of its South Asian Space Security Programs. Previously, he worked in the Carter administration on Capitol Hill and at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of 20 books, including Better Safe Than Sorry, The Ironies of Living with the Bomb, and Deterrence, Stability, and Escalation Control in South Asia. And he has an article at the New York Times, The New Age of Nuclear Confrontation Will Not End Well. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with a man she loved. Standing along the side of the pickup truck. Bye.